Our next case this morning is number 072783, Floyd Hayes against Donald Snyder. Mr. Backman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'd like to actually start my argument with noting an error on my part. It's my part. It's not my client's part. I indicated I think once in the opening brief and a few times in the reply brief that Dr. Hamby had withdrawn both the ice packs and the ibuprofen. In reading more closely my client's deposition, he actually says no. He continued to get the ibuprofen. Dr. Hamby didn't actually prescribe it for him. But the April 17th visit to Dr. Shute, which was his last visit to Dr. Shute, Dr. Shute prescribed ibuprofen, and it appears that it was a three-month prescription. So my client would have had access to it through his meeting with the nurse on July 13th, who re-prescribed the ibuprofen.
The prescriber of that was?
Dr. Shute. Dr. Shute is the doctor. There is a doctor before Dr. Hamby sees Dr. Shute. Dr. Hamby sees my client twice face-to-face in October of 2001. Immediately before that, there was a doctor. We don't know his name. There was a doctor who saw my client and prescribed painkillers, Tylenol with codeine.
May I raise a kind of a threshold issue that I've thought about after reading your brief, and you can deal with it perhaps in your presentation? I found it difficult to – I could see where perhaps Dr. Hanley had been negligent, hadn't read this case right, and therefore underreacted to your client's plight. But I found it difficult to see – where he showed the requisite reckless disregard of your client's situation. In other words, that he really understood your client's situation as your client presents it and still said, well, the heck with him. That's all I'm doing.
Well, Judge, frankly, I don't see how he could have thought otherwise, at least by the time he gets my client's April 16th letter, the request to review the documents that comes from Ms. Lindley, I believe it is, after my client writes his April 16th letter. Dr. Hamby is certainly made aware that my client is very upset and is in pain. And he goes back and looks at the records. And what's interesting, Judge, and the reason I think this is clearly reckless disregard, if not worse, is two things. One, every other doctor who saw him wanted to prescribe painkillers and send him to a urologist. He didn't prescribe painkillers and didn't send him to a urologist. Now, even worse, Judge, and this is where...
Painkiller, but not a prescription painkiller.
Right, yes. He prescribed Tylenol on one...
With a narcotic, yeah.
Exactly, yes. And that's the usage my client used, painkillers, meaning that led to the confusion in the brief. But I really do want to stress here, there's another point, and it's really a chilling point when you read Dr. Hamby's deposition, and I tried to point it out a couple of times in my briefs. Dr. Hamby had a policy. He never prescribed a prescription strength pain relief. Now, that there are 2,000 people, he estimated, in that prison at any one time. He refused to prescribe anything stronger than Tylenol. So I really believe the question today, in light of that admission by him during his deposition, is not really was my client recklessly disregarded, because he clearly was. He suffered an agony from a testicle that was retracting constantly into his body. That's not the question. Was Dr. Hamby did he recklessly disregard my client? Sure he did. Every other doctor knew that you're an internist. You either prescribe or you really do both. You prescribe pain, you prescribe Tylenol 3 or something stronger, and you send him to a urologist to figure out why the man's testicle is inside his body. But he didn't do that. He's the only one who didn't see it this way, which is why I say he's more than negligent. But worse, Judge, he had a policy of never prescribing prescription pain medication to prisoners. And he explains because they never really need it. That was a shocking statement. I think really it leads to the question, not was my client's constitutional rights violated by Dr. Hamby, but how many others of the 2,000 people there, which is just statistically more than just my client, at some point needed prescription pain relief. And that's very simply, Judge, where I don't think this is a difficult case at summary judgment.
Could I ask you whether, on Judge Ripple's point in a way, to what extent is a doctor like Dr. Hamby, for example, required to credit subjective claims of pain from prisoners? Because reading the record favorably to your client, he is giving a pretty continuous set of reports of subjective significant pain. And Dr. Hamby apparently doesn't believe that the pain is there or takes the position that unless he can diagnose the problem, he doesn't send people out for a diagnosis.
Right, I think he said if he can't document the problem, the cause of the pain, then he won't send them to the person who can document the cause of the pain. Again, odd statement.
So part of your theory has to be in the face of these constant reports of pain, coupled with at least an observable physical event, manifestation.
Diagnosed by other doctors who saw him.
That other doctors recorded in their notes and diagnosed that is enough to cross the threshold from negligence over into deliberate indifference.
And surely, Judge, in answer to your question, I think the Seventh Circuit, I think this court, has answered that question, which is a doctor cannot, if a doctor makes a choice to discredit subjective reports of pain, he is rolling the dice. And I believe Greeno says it, and I believe Walker, Benjamin versus Walker versus Benjamin says it, and I believe several other cases say it, that is not, you can't disbelieve it. If you disbelieve it, if that's your ground, and you don't do anything further, you just don't believe it and walk away, and assume that the guy, I think the Seventh Circuit uses the term malingerer, if you just assume he's a malingerer, he's surfeited for drugs, now you're taking a risk. The risk is, and just to answer the question that should come, I would think, next, which is, does that mean anybody who reports pain gets a jury trial, or if the doctor doesn't believe him? And the answer is no, because he still has to demonstrate by evidence that the first part of the test, the objective component, which is that he actually had a serious medical condition.
Mr. Backman, do we know whether or not the defendant physician, when he was treating your client, did he have access to the clinical notes of the other physicians who had treated your client and had reacted differently than he did, treated it more seriously? Do we know for a fact that he was aware of their treatments?
For sure. He testifies himself, Dr. Hamby does, that on January, I believe it's 14th or 13th, he does a full jacket review. That means reviewing all the notes. And, of course, he says he does it again in his May 16th memo on request from Ms. Lindley. So the answer is yes.
We have more than the subjective pain here or continuous subjective complaints of pain. We also have the fact that the defendant physician also apparently didn't take at face value the diagnoses of other members of the profession.
By both Dr. Shute, who saw him after Dr. Hamby did in October, and the doctor who saw my client before Dr. Hamby in September 2001.
Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Burks.
Thank you. My name is Paul Burks. I represent the non-medical defendants, the prison officials who received Mr. Hayes' complaints about his medical care and then checked with the medical unit and then responded to those complaints. So not the treating physician at all, and I'll be taking just 4 minutes of the 10 minutes that have been allocated to the appellees. The standard here for deliberate indifference is knowledge of the objective harm, of the objective condition, and then consciously disregarding it. I'd just like to focus on the word disregarding, on that element of the claim. Did my clients disregard what they knew about Mr. Hayes' condition? And the standard for whether or not my clients disregarded it is set in two cases, very recent cases from this court. Greeno is one, and Johnson versus Doughty is the other. And in both those cases, the court said non-medical prison officials, when they receive complaints about medical care, can defer to the judgment of medical professionals who are treating the inmate. And in this case, when my clients received the complaints, my client's name is Defendant Bass, when she received the complaint, she checked with the medical unit. She received a 3-page summary of the care he was treating. The diagnosis was a cyst that sometimes became inflamed and caused discomfort. And that it was being monitored and treated and had been seen on many occasions. And she reported that back to Mr. Hayes that he had a cyst. He reported back, by return mail, said, wait a minute, I'm really in pain. It hurts a lot. She went back to the medical professionals. She checked with them again, and the medical director said he is not in need of any further treatment. Defendant Bass, under Greeno, was entitled to rely on that judgment of the medical professionals, and so therefore did not disregard, consciously or otherwise, anything that she knew about Mr. Hayes' condition. And I think that given the questions from the panel regarding the medical treatment and given the limited time, if there are no questions from the panel, I will rest on that particular element and leave it to my brief to discuss any of the other matters on which the judgment can be defended against my client.
Thank you, Mr. Burks.
Thank you.
And we'll hear now from Mr. Unrath.
Good morning. My name is Craig Unrath, and I represent the defendant, Dr. Hamby. Plaintiff's counsel is asking this court for quite a bit. He's asking this court to hold that a prison physician violates the Eighth Amendment when he fails to diagnose at a very early stage a rare and progressively worsening medical condition. Now, when I say rare, where do I get that? Well, I get this from his doctors in the Lexington, Kentucky.
But could I back up? In Dr. Hamby's deposition, he's asked the question, so if somebody were complaining about a severe pain or substantial pain and you couldn't document a cause, then would that person then not be able to see a specialist? And he answers, I wouldn't know which specialist to send him to if I can't come up with a documented cause for pain, such as, and then he goes on. And then there's more along the same line. And I think one of the problems here is that it's almost a circular set of reasons. Dr. Hamby says, I don't send people out for further diagnosis, even in the face of complaints of severe pain, unless I already know what's wrong with them. And no one in this case debates at all that a urologist was the right. It's not like Dr. Hamby couldn't figure out that a urologist was the right kind of specialist. It's in Dr. Shute's notes. It's in the file. So I'm not sure that this case is quite the unfair situation that you're portraying, where here's this poor doctor and it's a very rare disease and he doesn't have any idea and somebody's after the fact trying to blame him for it. Everybody already knows it's a urologist. He's ignoring these complaints of severe pain.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to first point out that the first time of he only saw the patient on two occasions.
And then he supervises afterwards. He's
right.
The medical director.
Right. And his first occasion that he met with this patient, the patient had no complaints of pain whatsoever.
But you're going back way before the time that Mr. Bachman begins. You're going back to when the cyst first develops, whereas
no.
My understanding of this case is that it's really when the muscular spasms begin that we're complaining here.
He was treated by Dr. Chowdhury. And Dr. Chowdhury,
whom we've seen before, by the way, but anyway.
Yes, and Dr. Chowdhury consulted with a urologist. And
but that was for the cyst. That's not when he's getting the spasms, which is a later event.
Absolutely. And we have, within the medical records, there is no evidence of chromatic muscular spasms.
But there is. There's later evidence that Dr. Shute reports even looking at the spasm as it happens, while, you know, seeing the testicle retracted up into the body.
And he came to the same diagnosis that Dr. Hamby did. He couldn't find any reason for this. And
doesn't that strike you as something that needs further inquiry? You don't just say, oh, too bad for you. You know, we don't know why
even,
this happened.
Even the Lexington physicians at the VA hospital acknowledge that this is a very rare condition.
But they figure it out. You send somebody to a specialist. Now, some diseases maybe nobody figures out, but, you know, you send them to a specialist.
And ultimately he did go to see a specialist, Dr. Amin, who found precisely the same symptoms that Dr. Hamby and Dr. Shute had found a precisely the same physical objective symptoms. You have to ask yourself, what good would it have done to send him to a urologist? Maybe it would have worked. What I can tell you is that the patient that Dr. Hamby saw was not the same patient that was in Lexington. The patient that Dr. Amin saw.
This is a new argument that you're making, and the pain and the spasms are constant throughout the period of time we're talking about.
I disagree with that entirely, Your Honor.
But we're not starting way back in 2000. We're starting later.
No, I'm talking about October 4th, 2001.
You're talking about, right, fall of 2001, and from that point onward, he's getting these spasms. He's having the physical effects of those spasms. That's the same thing they see in Kentucky.
Dr. Shute reviewed these symptoms. He could not find any objective reason for it. Dr. Hamby merely followed Dr. Shute's recommendation.
Dr. Shute recommended a urology consult, though.
But never bothered to file the paperwork for it.
It's written in his notes.
And he never filed the paperwork to do it. And then he saw the patient on numerous occasions after that and never once again, never repeated any request or acknowledgement that he needed to see a urologist.
And that's exonerating for what reason?
He made the request for or mentioned that he might need to see a urologist, and then he dropped the matter. He apparently changed his mind because when he spoke to saw the plaintiff again on numerous occasions, it never came up. He ultimately did see a urologist, Dr. Amin. Dr. Amin reported that the plaintiff was in no acute distress, that he saw no objective signs of pain. And it's not just Dr. Amin. It's his attending physician at the VA. That's his Dr. Lisa Barsanila.
Right, but somebody gives him Darvocet before he leaves the VA when he goes to
He complains of pain, and they gave him Darvocet. I don't see how that's... What I do see is this. Dr. Barsanila said he is well-nourished, well-developed, ambulatory, and not in acute distress.
Isn't that the nature of a spasm? I mean, you know, people who have Charlie horses can walk around and feel fine most of the time unless they happen to be having a Charlie horse.
Most doctors are going to want to find an objective reason for the pain before they're going to treat it, and that's not only true in the prison, but it's true in the Veterans Administration. Dr. Amin came to the same conclusion that he showed no signs, objective signs, that he was in any pain whatsoever. I'm afraid my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Unrath. How much time does Mr. Blackman have? Thank you.
Very briefly, I just want to take care of this issue about when the pain began. On September 24th, 2001, before the two Dr. Hamby visits, my client sees Dr. Chaudhry or some other doctor. I didn't realize that we had the name. In any event, he prescribes opiate strength pain relief, says, come back in 10 days if you still have pain. You need to go to a urologist. He comes back 10 days later, sees Dr. Hamby. My client's affidavit is clear. I said I'm in extreme pain from the testicular problems. Dr. Hamby says, first he says, take some Tylenol. Then he says, wear a jock strap. That'll do the trick. So there's absolutely no question. Every other doctor after that wants to prescribe pain relief. Dr. Amin, just very quickly, 15 minutes. He saw him when he first checked in. Dr. Amin had before him a record, a note from the prison saying my client's problems were psychiatric.
He's the first one at the first VA hospital.
The first one at the first VA hospital. Sees him for 15 minutes. Your Honor, frankly, I'd hope to spend a little more time on the Greeno matter, the Greeno and Johnson issue about the non-medical defendants, because I think that's where actually the interesting issue is here. But I'm out of time, so hopefully the briefs adequately have addressed it.
Thank you, Mr. Backman.
Thank you, Judge.
Our thanks to both Mr. Backman and to Mr. Burks and Mr. Unrath. The case will be taken under advisement.